The last sermon here is the end of our current series entitled Our Wave Sheaf. This is part three today. And I thought I'd just mention here concerning the wave sheaf, something was mentioned earlier, things that I take for granted sometimes, having grown up on the farm and maybe being a little more aware of some of those type of terms, but sometimes people that grow up in the city or whatever may not be familiar with the term wave sheaf, and it is S-H-E-A-F. A sheaf, in this particular case here, was if you went out and you cut some grain, take an example, whether it be barley or wheat or rye or whatever it might be, they have a stalk. It has a stalk, and at the top is a head of grain. And what they would do is cut the grain or the stalk close to the ground. And so that leave you, depending on how good a year it was, depending on the type of sheaf, but they would gather together a handful of those with the stalk in place and the heads on top, and that is a sheaf. And it would just be a bundle. It would be bundled up the size it would fit into a hand. Into your hand, a good size handful of the sheaf there, the stalks of the grain, if you will, the stalk that holds the grain about a foot and a half, 2 foot high, maybe a little longer sometimes, and with a head of grain on top. And that is what the wave sheaf is about. That was waved by the priest up in the air, back and forth, a wave back and forth toward God to be accepted for us. So again, here, just so you understand specifically what the wave sheaf was, we're going to be talking about something else today if we have a little more time concerning us. But that picture of Jesus Christ, as we read about back in Leviticus 23, who was waved before God to be accepted for us. So again here, let's begin today. Let's back up here and read once again Mark 15. It's the last section of verses we looked at here, just again to pick up the time from the time of the crucifixion. Mark 15 and verse 25. And it was the third hour, again being 9 a.m., and they crucified him. And jumping on down to verse 32, we already read these just at the close of the last service. Verse 32, it says, "Let Christ the King of Israel descend now from the cross, that we may see and believe. And they that were crucified with him reviled him. And when the sixth hour, being 12 noon, was come, there was darkness over the whole of the land until the ninth hour," until 3 p.m. So between 12 noon and 3 p.m. on the daytime portion of the Passover on the 14th, this was what was taking place. It corresponds with this year as well in the timing, in the sense of Wednesday during the day, time being the Passover day. This is when this took place. Let's turn over now to Luke chapter 23. Luke chapter 23. Various accounts here, a witness in that respect of how people saw things, and in essence here, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and things that they saw, and John, of what they saw and what they are going to be writing about, things that they were inspired to write of this account. And again here, Luke 23 and verse 38, and it says, "A superscription also was written over him in letters of Greek and Latin and Hebrew." So again here, I mentioned this earlier, how that there are those that have found fault with various phases or different things that they find in the Bible, and this is one, without having much knowledge themselves. People want to find fault, they're going to find fault. And if you remember earlier, the translation of one was the King of the Jews. And this one here translated says, "This is the King of the Jews." All a little different because they were in different languages, some of the that which was written. As it says here, there were letters in Greek, there were that which was written in Latin, and also that which was written in Hebrew. Verse 39, "And one of the thieves who was hanged, railed, spoke reproachfully to him." In other words, one of the thieves, there was one on each side of him. And it says one of them was speaking reproachfully to Christ. "If you are the Christ, save yourself and us." You know, if you're the Messiah, save yourself and us. Again, the disrespect and things we're showing even while he's hanging there dying himself. Verse 40, "But the other answered and rebuked him, saying, Don't you fear God, seeing you're in the same condemnation? And we indeed justly," in other words, we deserve what we're getting, "for we are receiving the due reward of our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong. And he said to Jesus, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom." You know, amazing. "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." Here's that expression that so many Protestants use to, as a proof of going to heaven. And this was one, if you remember, I remember on one of the interviews, I left it on there because I was already off, kicked off of the interview. But they came back a little bit later, and they were talking about, this was one of the verses, and I think it was mentioned more than once in the interviews, but this is one that they talked about, I can't say off the air, it was still on the air, but I wasn't on the air anymore. And they brought up this account here of the thief on the cross. And he said, as it goes on to say here, notice verse 43. And Jesus said to him, "Verily I say unto you, today shall you be with me in paradise." So there isn't a whole lot of forethought that goes through this or into this in the very comment that's made. But a lot of people have used this to say, well, see, Jesus Christ said, in essence, today you're going to be with me in heaven. That's the way it's taken. And that isn't what Jesus Christ said. And but that's how the Protestant world teaches it. And I've known people in the church who've been confused by this as well and not understanding what is being said here. So again here, a literal translation of this is, "Verily I say unto you today." In other words, I'm telling you this today. He didn't say, "Today you're going to be with me in paradise," because if you just think about it a little bit, what was going to happen to him? He wasn't going anywhere except into the sepulcher for 3 days, or even for them, as they believe, from at least a day and a half. So at least if he missed that day. So he wasn't going to be with him anywhere in heaven because he was dying. And obviously, people just think this through a little bit, but they don't think about things like this. And so he wasn't saying that today you're going to be with me in paradise or today we're going to be together in heaven. Nothing like that at all. He just says, "Verily I say unto you today that you shall be with me in paradise." What was he talking about? Well, because we understand God's plan. It's really very simple, isn't it? We understand that everyone, billions who have ever died, we know that there's going to be a time when everyone's going to be resurrected back to physical life again. And the truth was that Jesus Christ would see him then. "You will be with me in paradise. You're not going to be in this world. You're going to be in a different world. You're going to be resurrected." He didn't go through all that. He just told him the simplicity of a reality that was going to take place in the future. And after the 1,000 years on this earth is going to be paradise. The things that God has done and prepared, mankind keeping the Sabbath, mankind keeping the holy days, God's way of life enforced on the earth. There's only one religion on all the earth, only one government throughout the earth. Paradise compared to this world here. And the things that God does in preparation for that great time when all those people are going to be resurrected is an incredible thing to know and to understand. And that's all Jesus Christ was referring to. He was referring to that occasion in the great white throne when everyone's resurrected. And Jesus Christ will be there, just like he will be throughout the millennial period, on into that last 100 years, when this individual himself is finally resurrected. So he was just telling him on that day that they were dying, what was going to happen in the future. Amazing, isn't it? If you understand God's plan, there are things that just, they just are. You know that, but the world has to read other things into it because they have different beliefs. Verse 44, "And it was about the 6th hour, so when this took place, he'd already been there, hanging there for about 3 hours. And it says, "And this was about the 6th hour, 12 noon in other words. And there was darkness over all the earth until the 9th hour, until 3 p.m. And the sun was darkened, and the veil of the temple was rent in the midst. And when Jesus had cried with a loud voice, he said, 'Father, into your hands I commend my spirit.' And when he had said this, he gave up the breath of life." And so again, something that we all understand or have come to understand at least since about 1970 was that all of us have been given a spirit essence that makes us unique as human beings, the ability to think and reason, that essence that makes us unique, that is us, that is in our mind, that when we die, everything that we've ever been, every thought we've ever had, everything is in that essence. Now, you don't have the power to remember everything because of our weakness of our minds and physical, the way we are physically, but it's there. Everything is there, just like a recording, perfect. Everything about us that's ever been. And that is the essence that returns to God once we're dead. It's in God's hands. There's no life in it. It has to be given life again, and when there's a great resurrection for the 144,000, it's at that time that that essence is put back into a spirit body for those who are resurrected during the great white throne. That essence is put back into a physical body and given life. And so all the memories, everyone they ever knew, every situation in life they've ever lived through, it's in their mind. They're the same person. It's that spirit essence. And so this is what he was telling God. "I commend to you my spirit," because He was getting ready to die. As it says here, he gave up the breath of life. He died. Mark chapter 15. Let's go back over to Mark 15. Again, here are just different accounts, going back and forth, trying to keep this in a process of a time order. Some a little overlapping here and there, but we're progressing forward as we go through all this in the story. Mark 15 and verse 34. And at the ninth hour, so we know that's 3 p.m., Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which is being interpreted, my God, why have you forsaken me? And Jesus Christ knew why he was there. He knew the purpose of it all along, as other scriptures even talk about, that we've already read in the series. And certainly those things then, brethren, are stated. There are things that Jesus Christ said for the disciples and for us. This was certainly cried out, something that, the feeling that was there inside, but the knowing. It's like, you know, Father, if there's any other way, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. In other words, that's that which we feel as human beings, but that which we know, and he knew it fully, completely, powerfully. And so, why did this take place? In other words, why did he have to remain there and die like this? That's the point of it all. And that's the point we're to get from it all. It's for us. It's for our sins. That's why. God the Father couldn't be around sin. He was taking upon himself the sins of all mankind. That's what we're to learn from this. That indeed, he was by himself there, in that respect, taking upon himself the sins of all mankind, and he had to die. And that's exactly what it is. That's what it's all about. That's the message we're to receive from this. Verse 35. And some of them that stood by, when they heard it, said, Behold, he calls Elias. Now this is the way it's translated in the New Testament there. It's the word Elijah. He was not calling out for the prophet Elijah. Okay? You have to understand what it's saying here. There are things sometimes that are translated that are a little awkward in that respect as to what is being stated. But again here, you need to understand what Jesus Christ was going through and what those were saying. What does Elijah mean? If we understand the meaning of Elijah, the definition of it, then we'll know exactly what they were saying about him. The word means, my God is Yahweh. That's what Elijah means. My God is Yahweh. And so basically they were saying, he's calling out his God, Yahweh. It's exactly what they were doing. They were saying, he calls out to Elias. You know, and the translation of that, obviously, if we understand that, he's calling out to his God, Yahweh. That's all it's about. That's exactly what it means. And so they were not expecting, it was about God. It wasn't about Elijah the prophet. There are people who read this thing, why is he calling out for Elijah the prophet? That's a good question, because he wasn't. That's the bottom line. He is calling out for his God, Yahweh. And what an appropriate word to use after all we've gone through during the Feast of Tabernacles, to drive the point home of that which Jesus Christ understood with all of his being, that his Father, his God, was Yahweh, the eternal God. And so that's why they were saying what they said. Let's see, because this is who he's calling out to. They knew who he was calling out to. Amazing. And one ran and filled a sponge full of vinegar and put it on a reed and gave him to drink. But they said, let him alone and let's see whether Elijah? No. Whether his God, Yahweh, will come and take him down. Because that's his God. Okay? Let's see if his God, they had all their gods, they had all kinds of gods. Speaking of those who were there, those soldiers and so forth, and the superstitions of different religions that existed at that time. This is not talking about different ones that were Jews. It's talking about some of the soldiers who were around there at this particular time. And so that's a typical response. Let's see whether his God, Yahweh, because that's who the Jews spoke of. They spoke of Yahweh. They spoke of the eternal God. That's the word they used. They didn't use the word eternal God. They used the Hebrew Yahweh when they talked about God so often. They'd heard this a lot. They knew who that God was. That's the Jews' God. That's the God of the Jews. And so here Jesus Christ is calling out to his God, Yahweh. Let's see if he comes down and we'll save him. Let's see what happens here. Don't give him this. And Jesus cried with a loud voice, and he gave up the breath of life. Let's continue here with some of the flow here, going over to John 19. just pick up again, going back and picking up some things and putting everything in place. Everything leading up to this occasion when Jesus Christ died, because that's where we're at. We're at a period of time from things that are being said from 12 noon by different ones here, down to 3 o'clock or up to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and different accounts that are being stated here about the death of Jesus Christ. And we're backing up here a little bit. John 19, verse 31. The Jews, therefore, because it was the preparation, and so they're talking about all the preparation of the Passover afternoon, in other words, getting ready for all the sacrifices that were to take place that afternoon, and that would take place all the way to sundown, ready for the holy day, the high day, the first day of unleavened bread. So this is why it's referred to as a preparation. And it's a term like what we would use. Friday is a preparation day for the Sabbath. We understand that. But this is a holy day season, things that took place on the Passover day, and they were referred to as the preparation of the Passover sacrifices and so forth. Not of the lamb in the evening before. They knew full well what they were talking about. The Jews, therefore, because it was a preparation, that the bodies should not remain upon the cross on the Sabbath day. So again here, they're discussing something, and we understand, you know, when the world reads this, what do they read? They think that's why they have to have Friday, that Jesus Christ died on Friday. Because they don't understand the Sabbath. They don't understand a whole annual Sabbath. And so when they read this in the Protestant world, they think it's talking about Saturday. They don't get it. They don't understand. So they think it's the weekly Sabbath when they hear the word Sabbath. They have no concept in the Protestant world that there are annual high days as well as the weekly Sabbath. So when they come to this point here, that's why they have Jesus Christ dying at Friday sunset, you know, or Friday, you know, close to that point in time when he died. That's why they call it Good Friday. Because they don't get this. So again, the Jews, therefore, because it was a preparation that the body should not remain upon the cross on the Sabbath day. Notice what it says? If they just understood. In other places it talks about the Sabbath day, but here it spells it out. For that Sabbath day was an high day. We know what that means. The world doesn't. It's an annual holy day. It's a high day. It was the first day of unleavened bread. That's what they were approaching. Passover is next to this first high day, an annual Sabbath. So it says that the bodies should not remain upon the cross on the Sabbath day, sought after Pilate, that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. So this wasn't enough time. The reason they did this is because this wasn't enough time for an individual to suffocate. That's how they died as a whole. Their feet on top of each other, one nail driven through the feet. They were able to push up by their feet in order to continue to breathe. They were able to hold themselves up until they became so weak that they could no longer do that, their hands above their head, so that when they nailed one nail there, one nail below, basically so that as time went on, they didn't have enough strength to hold themselves up to breathe, and they would literally come to a point in time where they would suffocate. That's why there's one individual, he had a pastor in at one time talk about the possibility that Jesus Christ suffocated, because knowing that that's what happened to people. And you think, how stupid can you be? It tells you how he died. How could an evangelist in the church come to a point so blind that he could put doubt in people's minds and saying there might be a possibility of suffocation? Anyway, going on here. So this is the reason they went by and broke the legs, because if you broke the legs, they would suffocate immediately. They couldn't hold themselves up anymore. That's the whole point of why they broke the legs. And so it says that their legs might be broken and they might be taken away. Verse 32, then the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and of the other who was crucified with him. In other words, so that they would die quickly. Verse 33, but when they came to Jesus, they saw that he was already dead, and they didn't break his legs. For one of the soldiers, see, it's telling you why. For one of the soldiers, or because, in other words, it's the word here that's used, showing what had happened, why he was already dead. For one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately there came out blood and water. And when that happens, you die. My God, why have you forsaken me? And he said, you know, receive my spirit. And he died. Everything happened quickly. Didn't last long when it came to this point. And he who saw it bear record, and his record is true. And he knows that he said true, that joy, that you might believe. Verse 36, for these things were done that the scripture might be fulfilled. And over again, it says certain things were happening to fulfill the scriptures. Not a bone of his shall be broken. So again, speaking of Jesus Christ, His legs weren't to be broken as a part of a normal process that would take place at that quickly before a Sabbath. And again, another scripture said, they shall look on him whom they pierced. So they killed him. A spear went into his side. And so they were looking upon him, it says, whom they had pierced. And it says, out came water and blood. He died. Didn't take long. Matthew 27. Let's turn over to Matthew 27. Matthew 27, and we're going to pick up the flow now in verse 57. And it says, and when the even was come, so again here, you know, things that sometimes people read into something, they say, well, you know, now it was even, the sun had gone down. No, it hadn't. Be careful what you read. See, people do things like this all the time. It says, and when the even was come, so it was approaching sundown, just before the first day of unleavened bread was to begin. It wasn't yet that day. There are certain things that had to take place here before that day ever began. And indeed, it's clarified in other accounts. But sometimes people will jump the gun, just as I mentioned here recently, that I got this thing that this fellow wanted to send to me because he'd gotten all this great understanding about Passover, and some of the things he came up with were so far out in left field that it's hard to think that the mind can even go that far because of what he read about what we understood John said about 6 o'clock. So he knew there was a great contradiction about the Passover, you know. He didn't understand that he was using Greek time and Roman time and talking about 6 a.m. in the morning. And so he thought there was a conflict because of things it says about later on about the third hour and the ninth hour and the sixth hour. Incredible. The stupidity of mankind. So when the even was come, there came a rich man of Arimathea named Joseph, who also himself was Jesus' disciple. You can hold your finger here if you want to turn another scripture, but I'm going to turn over another area here. Just talk about this, but you can stay here if you want to because we're coming right back to this. And I'll just read this to you in Mark 15, verse 42, another account. I'll just read this. Mark 15 and verse 42. It says, and now when the even was come, because it was the preparation, that is, the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea, an honorable counselor, who also waited for the kingdom of God, came and went in boldly unto Pilate and craved the body of Jesus. So again here, understanding, brethren, I was talking about this, that not to read things into it. We'll come back to some of this a little bit later. But again, just giving another account here of something about Joseph of Arimathea, and that his desire was he believed what Jesus Christ said. And certainly one of the disciples that had remained faithful, a rich individual at that, who already had a place close to Golgotha there, where he was able to take Christ as soon as he had died and put him in his sepulcher. Let's continue on here with, let's go back here to Matthew 27 and continue on here about Joseph of Arimathea. The point of all this was in Mark 15, was showing the time here, and it says, now when the even was come, because it was a preparation, it was still a preparation. In other words, sundown hadn't occurred yet. It was still in the preparation. That is, the day before the Sabbath. So it was a preparation, which is the day before the Sabbath. It was during the Passover day. So that's why I went over here to show the specific timing when Joseph of Arimathea went to ask for the body of Christ. Sundown hadn't taken place yet. It was still the preparation day, and that's when it says even was come. It's an expression that's used. It doesn't mean that they're already into the even. It's like what we would see here. We see the sun's getting close to going down in the evening. It's not quite there yet. It hasn't gone down. It's not the next day yet. But it's approaching it quickly. And that's basically what was being said here. Getting close to the end of the day. So again, Matthew 27, verse 57. When the even was come again, there came a rich man of Arimathea named Joseph, who also himself was Jesus' disciple. He went to Pilate and begged the body of Jesus. Then Pilate commanded the body to be delivered. And when Joseph had taken the body, he wrapped it in clean linen cloth and laid it in his own new tomb, which I guess it was his sepulchre hewn out of the rock. In other words, it was his and it had been hewn out of the rock already. And not many people were able to do things like that. It took money in order to build something like this and in order to have something like this made for you.
And it talks about how he went on, then he rolled a great stone to the door of the sepulcher and departed. So again, he wrapped the body in the linen cloth, laid him in there, and then had the stone rolled over. And it says there, and there was Mary Magdalene and other Mary sitting over against the sepulcher. So they witnessed this thing taking place right up to the point of sunset. And let's turn over to Matthew 12 and read on from there. We'll back up here a little bit concerning some things that Jesus Christ said, although I know as a whole we all know this, but I just want to drive the point home in the context of things that are being said here. Because we're at a point in time now where we've gone all the way up almost into the first day of the week. It's not quite the first day of the week. The even was there upon them, and quickly they were able to take the body and wrap it and have the stone rolled in front of the door. So let's consider some of the timing that of what followed and the actual time of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Matthew 12, verse 38. Then certain of the scribes and Pharisees answered, saying, Master, we would like to see a sign from you. And he answered and said unto them, An evil and an adulterous generation seeks after a sign. And there shall no sign be given it but the sign of the prophet Jonah. You know, how often for us are there things we would like to see in the church? We'd like to see certain things done to help drive the point home. If we could just see this or that, if we could have, you know, the wool on one side be wet and the ground, and vice versa, you know, and different stories of things we can think about. And yet when it really comes right down to it, you know what God is concerned with? And what is far more meaningful, brethren, for us, being in the church, as we have been for some time, it's what's in your mind. It's the faith we're able to live by because we believe. You recognize, do you understand that one of the primary ways that we are justified in the sense of, yes, in and through Jesus Christ, but what God attributes righteousness to us, it's not because we are, it's because of what we believe and our willingness to act upon it, to live by faith. Talks about Abraham, Paul talks about Abraham, and because he did what God said, it wasn't because Abraham was righteous. We all have sin, all human beings do. But it says because he believed, in essence, it was attributed to him for righteousness. And that's what God does to all of us. It's what we believe. It's what we choose to live by because we believe God, because we believe what he says. And God is far more concerned with that, that what he places into your mind that you believe and you live by those things, and we're tried by it. What are we going to do? Are we going to do what God says the way God says to do it? Do we believe him when he says to flee idolatry? You know, we had to go through hard things to learn some of those lessons. Truly did, to drive the point home more. So that whenever anything would arise, we would be so deeply convicted of it. God takes us through a process of conviction. And so again here, it's kind of like what we talked about earlier. The ability to do God's will, his law being written in our hearts and minds. Well, this is another one, because the purpose of God's way of life being written in your heart and mind is that we think at one with God, that we think more as God, in a sense of being at one with him, that we agree with him, and that we choose to do things the way he shows us, the way he reveals it to us. And so he went on to say here, an evil and an adulterous generation seeks after a sign. And so in other words, it's like, we're not going to believe you until we see something. And I think of this generation and the church, that even more so, people live by faith. And more, the farther we go along, the more we're learning to do that than ever before in our lives, quite candidly. An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and there shall no sign be given it but the sign of the prophet Jonah. So he said there's going to be a sign, and this is the only one, in essence, that's going to prove that he is who he said he was, that he is the Messiah. This is what was going to take place to prove that he was the Messiah. He said, For as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the great fish's belly, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. Amazing thing. So often in the world around us, different ones that talk to us, maybe about Friday sunset. You know, how many of you have had those kinds of conversations with relatives or friends or whatever, work associates, about Friday sunset to Sunday morning? You can't get 3 days and 3 nights. That's why I always love the way Mr. Armstrong was inspired to write what he wrote about this. If you go back to Jonah and go back to the Hebrew, and it says 3 days and 3 nights, you can't get around anything but 3 full days and 3 full nights, 72 hours. That's how long he was going to be in the heart of the earth. You can play around with some of the Greek, but you can't with Hebrew. That was the point he made when he wrote that particular article about this. And even in that, even though in the Protestant world, they play around with some of this. Even at that, if they're fully faithful in all this, there is no way on earth that you can twist anything to get from Friday afternoon to Sunday morning and somehow say that there are three nights in there somehow and three daytime periods in there somehow. Try it. Isn't that amazing? Friday, part of the day, Saturday, all day. Sunday, well, they said they all went there, and before the sun had come up, that he was already risen. But they cheat a little bit, and they squeeze a little bit of daylight in there, so they get there 3 days. Isn't that amazing? Then Friday night, Saturday night. It's hard to cheat on that one, isn't it? Isn't that amazing? Absolutely incredible the way the world thinks. They don't think it through in any fashion or form, because it's very specific. It says 3 days and three nights, not just 3 days. So they play their little games because they have to prove something. Their Catholic beliefs. That's where it came from. They have to prove their Catholic beliefs. Every Protestant, everyone out there that calls themselves in traditional Christianity, that believes in a Sunday morning Easter sunrise service and Good Friday, they all got it from the same place. They didn't come up with it on their own. They got it from the same church, from the Catholic Church. Isn't that amazing? People don't like that. Too bad. You think even the Mass of Christ would teach them something. Oh, Christmas, where'd that come from? You know, but it doesn't. They don't understand. They believe that one because it came from the same church, the Mass of Christ, Christmas. But they don't get it. They don't understand it. So simple, so basic. The Trinity. And the Nicene Creed, where do they get it? Boy, they don't like this, the Protestant world. Their major doctrines, they all came from the Catholic Church. So if they come out of the Catholic Church, why didn't you stay with them? Huh. It's kind of like the scattered church today. You know, everybody has their own little beliefs and they have their own justifications of why they don't have to keep doing what they're doing, you know. Amazing, the human mind. I marvel at the patience and the mercy of God and the time He's given. But He's given 6,000 years and that's His plan and purpose and He's going to do it that way. Thankfully, we're at the end where man's rule is coming quickly to an end. So again, he says he's going to be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. Now, it doesn't say that's how long he's going to be dead. It says that's how long he's going to be in the heart of the earth. As soon as the stone was rolled over, that's when the count began. 3 days and three nights. So when did this occur? Well, Joseph of Arimathea was working hard to get it done, because he believed on things that he had about the holy day as well. He went and quickly begged the body so he could take it down and for the same purpose, so that he could have everything done before sundown. And you can know that he got everything done before sundown. And that stone may have been rolled up there right at that point in time, but it was rolled up there. Wednesday for us, just like this past year, this year here, Wednesday at sundown, right at the point of sundown. And then, as soon as that was over, the first high day. First high day began. So amazing here. So if he was placed in the heart of the earth just before sundown on the 14th, so everything happened on the 14th to fulfill the complete cycle here from the very moment, the very beginning of the lamb being killed, because it could be killed immediately after sundown, the Passover lamb. So you have things taking place here that can happen the moment the sun goes down, and Jesus Christ fulfilled it all to the moment the sun went down again. Isn't that amazing? A perfect, complete picture of Jesus Christ being our Passover, being the sacrifice, sacrificing Himself for the sins of all mankind, dying and being put in the heart of the earth, dead. And He was dead for 3 days and three nights. No life, nothing else existing. He had already asked the Father to receive His Spirit, just like when we die, a spirit returns to God, that spirit essence. And what does that mean? It means we have to wait for a resurrection. Everyone who's ever died of human beings throughout time, that spirit essence has returned to God. It's not alive. It's just an essence. It's like a tape recording, like we've talked about. It's like a part of a, what could you say? What are these little things today? They plug hard drive, yeah, or a hard drive, or even those little, what do they have, 4 gigs now? They can use these little flash drive, thank you, he's fast here. Flash drives, you know, it's incredible, just a little thing. And think of what this is. This is something that is, please understand, it's spirit. It's a spirit essence. It's not even physical. That's what makes us different from animals in that respect, in the sense of what is stored in there that returns to God. They have been given something that's programmed into them that of itself is of a spirit essence, programmed, but not like human beings. Ours gives us the ability to think and reason that is different. Incredible. There is no life without God. Incredible. And God sustains all life. Do we understand that the physical universe is sustained by spirit? Sustained by God Almighty, by His power, everything. Without God, it wouldn't be there. Incredible. But this is something that returns to God, that records everything we are, has everything about us. And so just like with Jesus Christ, everything that He was there. But He had to wait, just like we do, for a body and for a life, a body that has life. That's why when God gives us a spirit body and places that essence back into it, it's for eternity. Incredible, from that point on. So again, if He was placed in the heart of the earth just before sundown on the 14th, which was Wednesday at sundown, then again, when was He resurrected? Well, obviously, we would count forward one day to the point just before sundown on Thursday, which is the first high day. And then the next day is Friday, so we count forward a second day. So this is a preparation for the weekly Sabbath. And so the second day forward to just before sundown on Friday. And then the third day, we count forward to a period just before sundown on the Sabbath, the weekly Sabbath. Jesus Christ was resurrected exactly 3 days and three nights from the point the stone was rolled over the sepulcher. Not even on the first day of the week. He was resurrected on the Sabbath. Isn't that amazing? Incredible. So again, Jesus Christ was resurrected at the end of the Sabbath during the days of unleavened bread. And these events would have actually followed the same, again, timing as what we had this year. Matthew 28. Jumping ahead now. Matthew 28 and verse 1. It's amazing to me how we can read things. You know, we all human beings do this. If we have certain beliefs in our mind, we're going to read everything accordingly, which is understandable. The only thing is if we're wrong, it's going to interfere with what we read. And so God is ever leading us, revealing to us, showing us what things mean. There's so much of the Bible, brother, we don't understand yet. There's so much that we don't know. So much we don't know about the millennial period. So much we don't understand about the great white throne. You know what? I know what's in here, but I don't know what it is yet. It's in this book. We just don't know what it is. It hasn't been shown to us yet. Incredible. Matthew 28, verse 1, in the end of... It's a word that literally means after, in other words. In the end of the Sabbath, better said after the Sabbath, as it began to dawn, and the Greek word here means to grow light. When does that happen? Toward the first day of the week. When does it ever begin to grow light toward the first day of the week? Well, it can't be. See, if you're talking about the first day of the week, you're talking about the period. It has to be after the Sabbath, but that's nighttime, because the day begins at night. See, it's the words we use. But the cycle of time that we count the Sabbath by, as we understand, is from sundown to sundown. And it always begins at a rev, you know, at a point in time. That when the sun is down, a new day begins, that's when the day begins. But it's nighttime. And so the light for the first day of the week, when do you see it? In the morning, exactly. When the sun starts to come up, it happens as soon as there's a first bit of light in the sky, and all of a sudden you realize the beginning of light. And this is what it's talking about. When it first begins to grow light, and it first begins to grow light, a dawning begins to take place well before the sun is actually up. So you actually have light in the sky, and this is what it's talking about. So it's saying after the Sabbath, it had to be after the Sabbath, because what follows that? The first day of the week. As it began to dawn, or as the Greek literally means, to grow light toward the first day, or the first of the week. It's really not even, the word day is not even in there. It just means the first of the week, which we understand is the first day. Came Mary Magdalene and the other Mary to see the sepulcher. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for the angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat upon it. His countenance was like lightning, and his raiment white as snow. And for fear of him, the keepers did shake, and became as dead men. And the angel answered and said unto the woman, Fear not you, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. And so, again, this is the way Matthew wrote the account. But we have to be careful what we read into it. It's not everything is always given in a specific time order of events. It's just going back and telling everything that happened. It's saying it began to dawn toward the first day of the week. So Mary Magdalene and the other Mary, it says, came to the sepulcher. And basically, there had been an earthquake, and different things took place here. And so we go on to verse 6. He just said, he isn't here. So by the time they got here, he said, he's not here. For he has risen. And the literal Greek means, for he was raised. He's not here. So all these things about sunrise services and the time of the resurrection, it didn't happen here. The angel was letting him know he's not here. He's already risen. For he is not here, for he has risen, or for he is raised, as he said. Come and see the place where the Lord was lying. And go quickly and tell his disciples that he is risen from the dead. He is alive. He is not dead. And literally means that he was raised. Go tell them that he was raised from the dead. And behold, he goes before you into Galilee. There you shall see him. Behold, I have told you. And so the angel was telling them, come look where he was. He isn't here. Be assured, he's not here. He's already gone before you. He's going before you into Galilee. Go tell the rest. And so verse 8, and they departed quickly from the sepulchre with fear and great joy, and did run and bring his disciples word. You can't imagine the emotion. You know, raised from the dead, you know. And for what they saw, the angel was there that spoke to them and told them these things. Mark chapter 16. Again, these accounts are all over the place. Sometimes if you have a harmony of the Gospels, you can see them a little more easily because they're kind of together on a page. They can put all four accounts when there are four accounts being spoken of by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And sometimes a harmony of the Gospels, if you've ever seen that particular book, keeps them in a fashion where you can read across the other page and get something quickly of the exact same account. And that's basically what we're doing here today, trying to keep the accounts closer together. But one might add more and one add less in some things that are being said. Mark 16 and verse 1, it says, And when the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Salome, says, had bought sweet spices. So let's ask a question for us. When would we be able to go and buy the sweet spices if we understand the laws of God? And when the Sabbath was passed, it talks about them going and buying the sweet spices that they might come and anoint him. So this was their desire. They wanted to prepare the spices, but they couldn't do it on the first day, on the first high day. They couldn't go and buy the spices then, and they didn't have time. They couldn't prepare them then because that would have been in contradiction to God's law and how to keep the annual Sabbath or a weekly Sabbath. So they didn't do any of the preparation of these spices, nor go buy them on the annual Sabbath, nor was it the weekly Sabbath. It was Friday. It was on Friday. They went and purchased these things, and then they began the work of preparing them so that they could take them to the sepulcher later. And so this is the story we're reading about. And very early in the morning, the first day of the week, they couldn't go on the weekly Sabbath to do this because that would have been breaking God's law to remove the stone and to go in there and to do these things. So they were being obedient to the law of God, the way of God. And so it says very early in the morning, the first day. So this is the first opportunity they really had because they didn't have time on Friday to do it. And this is what it's discussing here. Very early in the morning, the first day of the week, they came into the sepulchre at the rising of the sun. And they said among themselves, Who shall roll us away the stone from the door of the sepulchre? How are they going to do this in order to go in there? And when they looked, they saw that the stone was rolled away, for it was very great. And they entered the sepulchre, and they saw a young man sitting at the right side. So, see, each one gives an account of how it happened by focusing in and saying different things about the account. That they were witness of these events, talked about these events from some of the different ones and what was said and so forth. And so they recorded it as to what different witnesses had said. And they entered in the sepulchre. They saw a young man sitting on the right side, clothed in a long white garment, and they were afraid. Well, let's jump over to Luke 23. Sorry, but we need to keep jumping around to get these different accounts and put them all together. But I'm giving them to you in an order here of these actual events as they were occurring. Luke 24. Luke 23, in verse 50. Backing up here a little bit again. And behold, there was a man named Joseph, a counselor, and he was a good man and just. The same had not consented to the counsel and deed of them. He was of Arimathea, a city of the Jews, who also himself waited for the kingdom of God. It says, this man went into Pilate and begged the body of Jesus, and he took it down and wrapped it in linen and laid it in the sepulchre that was hewn in stone, wherein never had a man been laid before. And it goes on to say in verse 54, and that day was the preparation, and the Sabbath drew on. Luke 23, and continuing on in verse 54, even this one drives it home even more so. Notice, and that day was the preparation, and the Sabbath drew on. See, so it's still the preparation day. Again, just another way of saying the same thing as what we said earlier when we were jumping around in Matthew and Mark earlier. Just to drive the point home, the preparation, meaning the preparation day, the preparation of the Passover sacrifices, the different ways it's referred to, and the Sabbath drew on. So this, in other words, the Sabbath was getting closer, and we were right up to this point in time. It was so close, in other words, to this point that he had to do this quickly, to ask for the body and to hurry back and to be able to wrap it and to put the seal on the door or the stone on the door. Verse 55, and the women also which came with him from Galilee followed after and beheld the sepulchre and how the body was laid. And they returned and prepared spices and ointments. So again here, it's saying they went back and prepared. Well, we already know they didn't do it. They couldn't do it the first day. And it says, and they rested the Sabbath day. See, so you get a little more of the story. So, you know, it's so clear, isn't it? I hope it's clear by saying this. It should be. You know that they didn't do it on the first high day. They prepared. They went and bought the things. And it was right up to sunset, so we know why they didn't do it on the first day. So they did it on Friday. They prepared the spices and the ointments, and it says, and they rested the Sabbath day. We know this was the weekly Sabbath thing, because that's what followed their preparation and their buying of all these spices, according to the commandment. Isn't that amazing? I mean, it's beautiful when you see how things fit together and how sound and everything is in the Bible, and how it agrees one area to another. All these accounts agree with one. Going on here, Luke 24, verse 1. Now, upon the first day of the week, very early in the morning, so we've already talked about this in another form, they came unto the sepulchre, bringing the spices which they had prepared, and certain others with them. And they found the stone rolled away from the sepulchre. So again, just driving the point home as to the timing and the specifics of all this, and how all four accounts agree in one. Everyone's saying something a little bit different, but they fit hand in glove. Another area, John 20. John chapter 20. We'll begin reading in verse 1. John 20, and beginning in verse 1. It says, "And the first day of the week came Mary Magdalene early, when it was yet dark." So, in other words, it wasn't daylight yet. Different expressions that are used here. There was a little bit of light starting. So again, here's just another way of saying it. In other words, it wasn't daylight yet. The sun hadn't risen yet. There was still the darkness in the sky. But it was getting, you know, there was enough to begin to see. So in other words, very early in the morning, when it was yet dark, came unto the sepulchre and saw the stone taken away from the sepulchre. Then she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciples, whom Jesus loved, and said unto them, "They have taken away the Lord out of the sepulchre, and we don't know where they have laid him." And Peter therefore, it says, went forth, and the other disciple, and came to the sepulchre. So we're hitting different accounts here and different timing of things that took place that morning. It says they both ran together, and the other disciple outran Peter and came first to the sepulchre. They were on the move. They were going as quickly as they could, obviously. And he, stooping down and looking in, saw the linen cloth lying, he didn't go in at that point in time. He just saw the cloth there. Then Simon Peter came following him, and he went into the sepulchre. The first didn't go in. He did. And it says, and he saw the linen clothes there, and the napkin that was about his head, about Christ's head, not lying with the linen clothes, but wrapped together in a place by itself. And verse 8, John 20. Then went in also that other disciple, which came first to the sepulchre, and he saw and believed, for as yet they knew not the Scripture. Isn't that amazing? Notice this. Christ told them so many things, but there are things they did not understand in what he said. They believed as they told him that he was the Messiah, that he was the Anointed One, that he was sent from God, that he was the Son of God. There were those things they deeply believed. But there are so many things that Christ taught and said that they did not get. And notice this, they did not get this. For as yet they knew not the Scripture that he must rise again from the dead. How many times did they hear him? What did he hear from them? What did they hear from him? You know, in the example of Jonah, 3 days and three nights, they didn't understand those things. And they didn't understand that he was going to be resurrected from the dead. Now, to me, that's an amazing thing to understand. You know, this was an incredible event that was taking place. And then, as they go through some of these things, things begin to come to them and they begin to see and understand. And it took them all the way up to Pentecost, finally, when the Spirit was poured out. And then all those things came rushing in together, and it says, and they knew. They understood then. They were able to bring the teachings of Christ together in a powerful way because of God's Spirit very powerfully within them. Verse 10, then the disciples went away again unto their own home. But Mary stood without the sepulchre weeping. And as she wept, she stooped down and looked into the sepulchre and saw two angels in white sitting, the one at the head and the other at the feet where the body of Jesus was lain or had lain. And verse 13, and they said unto her, woman, why do you weep? And she said unto them, because they've taken away my Lord, and I don't know where they've laid him. Still didn't get it here. In this particular account of what she was experiencing. You know? And they still didn't understand certain things here, even as they were told some of these things that had taken place. They didn't understand. They didn't get it. That he, you know, even the resurrection that had taken place, they fully didn't grasp about the Scriptures and what was said. And so she was there weeping, and she was expecting the body had been taken someplace. Verse 14. So a lot of confusion, though. And then at the other point where we read, where they finally saw and they ran with joy and yet fear. And when she had thus said or said this, she turned herself back and saw Jesus standing. And she didn't know that it was Jesus. And Jesus said unto her, woman, why do you weep? Whom do you seek after? And she, supposing him to be the gardener, said to him, sir, if you've carried him away from here, tell me where you have laid him, and I'll take him away. And Jesus said unto her, Mary. She turned herself and said unto him, Rabboni, which is to say, Master. And Jesus said to her, do not touch me, for I am not yet ascended to my Father. And so, as it says here, as we understand, brethren, this is the complete picture of what we've been talking about here, of something that was back in Leviticus, the wave sheaf. Had to be waved before God to be accepted by God for us. Jesus Christ was the wave sheaf. He was resurrected from the dead, but making it very clear, when was the wave sheaf waved up before God? This time. It was a ceremony they went through year by year. It was cut beforehand, and then it was waved up when? At the first day of the week. At this time. And then God tells him how to count Pentecost. From this time forward. It's from the time that the wave sheaf is accepted by God for us. And so this is when the high priest would go out and wave the wave sheaf. And this is the very symbolism that Jesus Christ is going to fulfill here now after this moment. So he's making it very clear here, and this is why it's written for us, that Jesus Christ had not yet been received of the Father for us. It is an awesome thing to understand the beauty, the perfection of all the events and the timing that took place here. And this is one of them. Incredible to understand the story as you go through it piece by piece like this. And so again, she was not allowed to touch him. He was resurrected from the dead. He had been resurrected the night before on the pass, just right at the point of the end of the Sabbath and into the night of the first day of the week. He was already, had been already resurrected. And this moment finally came then, where he was able to talk to someone, and he talked to her. And he said, don't touch me, though. And even though she was the first to be given recognition of who he was and so forth, and so he had not yet been received as our wave sheaf. So again here, verse 17, he said, Jesus said unto her, do not touch me, for I am not yet ascended to my Father, but go to my brethren and say unto them, I ascend to my Father and your Father, and to my God and your God. Isn't that meaningful? You know, a little more meaningful than it was last year. It really should be, brethren. It should be just a little bit more meaningful, with a little bit more appreciation and excitement about what was taking place at this time. This would be the first time. This would be the first time that Jesus Christ would be before the Father in spirit, in reality, in actuality, the very throne of God. It's an awesome thing to understand. For he was going to heaven itself, the only one to ever ascend to heaven of all mankind, the only one who would. You know, amazing. Making it very clear that he was the only one to come back down as well. And he would do it on a regular basis. I am coming. Until the time he did come or would come. Incredible. So Mary Magdalene came and told the disciples that she had seen the Lord and that he had spoken these things unto her. So again, incredible fulfillment here of what is given. Jesus Christ is the wave sheaf, and this is the specific occasion that fulfills this. Let's turn back now to Leviticus 23. We've gone through the entire story here of a process that took time. From the very moment that Jesus Christ told the disciples, go and prepare that we may eat the Passover together. And the work that they did then, and just like they always had for hundreds of years, the Jewish people, in getting a lamb and all getting together in one particular group, killing the lamb after sunset, beginning in the 14th, and then cleaning the thing to the point they had to do as far as the outside and so forth. There were those things, they left everything inside of it. They started roasting it, and they told them how to roast it by fire. And the things that took place, some of those things not totally specific, but they did it exactly like they did back in Exodus, and cooked it accordingly, or roasted it accordingly. And then they began to eat. Jesus Christ instituted the symbols of the Passover afterwards. Went and prayed the times that he did. Oh, incredible, the entire picture and the entire time here. Taught the things that he taught that we read year by year by year in John 14 through 17. And then all that took place from the time they went and took him from the area, betrayed him, as Judas did, and all the way up to the point in time we just got through here with after his resurrection and telling Mary not to touch him, that he had not yet ascended. He had not been received by God as our wave sheaf offering. Leviticus 23, God does everything perfectly in timing, brethren. Everything has great meaning to it, and he does it exactly according to what he's always done and always said. That's why I marvel about the times we're in. I marvel about the times that started with the first seal being opened and the things that were revealed to us, have been given to us, about what was to take place in the church and all the things that are taking place now and where we are now and what is getting ready to take place. Luke 23, verse 9. Everything in its perfect timing, in God's perfect timing, exactly the way God intends it to be. Going back here to Leviticus 23 now, and picking up the story, let's pick it up in verse 9 once again, where we began this entire series of our wave sheaf offering in part 1 in Leviticus. And the Eternal spoke unto Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, and say unto them, when you have come into the land which I give you, and shall reap the harvest thereof, then you shall bring a sheaf of the first fruits. And so it's talking about this stalk of grain with the head on top. So again, it could be a foot and a half, 2 foot long with the grain still on top. And this is what the sheaf was. It was a bundle, small bundle. That's all a sheaf is, a small bundle tied together. And they were to take this out of all the harvest that was taking place. They were to retain this, keep this for this specific occasion. And so it talks about here then the process of what they were going to do with it. And as I mentioned in that first sermon, this word here is not the word for fruit. There's no fruit in this word whatsoever. There's another word later on that means first fruit. This word just means the beginning, the beginnings. So again here, it can be first, but again, the sheaf of the first of your harvest. So this is a first great harvest. It's the beginnings of their harvest, if you will. There are others to come, and so this is what is taking place. Out of the beginning of all their harvest, they were to save this part back, this wave sheaf. And so God, you know, it's an incredible thing when you go into Joshua chapter 5 and you read about when they did come in the promised land. This is exactly what was taking place and the timing of events of what happened there. And so it says here again that you shall take a sheaf of the beginning of your harvest unto the priest. And as I mentioned before, a literal translation from Green's Interlinear Bible says that when you come into the land, which I am giving you, and have reaped its harvest, and have brought in the sheaf of the beginning of your harvest to the priest. So it's very clear here, literal translation of the Hebrew. Verse 11, as it goes on to say here, and he shall wave the sheaf before the Eternal to be accepted for you. And so again here, that which is brought into the high priest, and at this particular time it gets real specific, on the morrow after the Sabbath, which means the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. And so again here, this is speaking specifically of the weekly Sabbath that happens during this period of time. The actual sheaf that was to be offered up, this is where some people become confused when concerning the particular thing that is done here, when the actual waving is taking place, because the waving of the sheaf has to take place inside the days of unleavened bread, or else it has no meaning. And so the Sabbath it's referring to, if you understand the Sabbath, if there's a period of time, there's only going to be one Sabbath as a whole, a weekly Sabbath that will fall within the days of unleavened bread. But if the Sabbath happens to be the last day of unleavened bread, and you were to offer it the next day, which one minister does on the East Coast, then they'll keep everything a week late. Because then they offer the wave sheaf after the days of unleavened bread are over. This can't be after the days of unleavened bread are over. And if people only understood Joshua 5, it makes it very specific, because in that year, Passover was on the Sabbath. The first day, Sunday, was on Sunday. And from that point on, if you go through and read all those things, you'll know exactly when to count. The wave sheaf is very clear in what they did and the events that took place at that particular time of the year. Because it has to do with the Passover and the Sabbath and when you would do offer the wave sheaf. And the wave sheaf was always offered on the first day of the week, past the Sabbath, in other words. And that's what it's showing here. On the morrow, the day after the Sabbath, it's talking about a weekly Sabbath. It's not an annual Sabbath. If it was an annual Sabbath, it's always the same year by year. In this particular case here, and some Jews, some sects of the Jews have counted it that way, your time for Pentecost would vary a great deal here. So again here, it varied year by year, and that's why if you understand what happened when they came into the Promised Land, and you can go back and review some of those sermons or read some of the things written about Pentecost and the timing of Pentecost and so forth. But again, it says, he shall wave the sheaf before the Eternal to be accepted for you. So just like Jesus Christ, it was on the first day of the week, on Sunday, and that's when the sheaf was offered up before God, and that's when Jesus Christ ascended to his Father. And that's what fulfilled the picture of the wave sheaf. It says, on the morrow after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. So again, the wave sheaf has to be inside the days of unleavened bread. And that was a point I was making because, again here, when the Passover falls on the Sabbath day, that's the Sabbath you count from when offering the wave sheaf. The wave sheaf would have been on the very first day of the days of unleavened bread, because that would be on Sunday, right? Okay, because that's on Sunday. If you wait till the following Sabbath and offer the wave sheaf that Sunday, days of unleavened bread are over, and it would have no meaning as to the fulfillment of the beauty of everything we picture today, falling all within the days of unleavened bread, and what Jesus Christ means as our wave sheaf to take away the sins of all the world. It has meaning within the picture of the plan of the holy days. Outside the holy days, it doesn't have any meaning. And that's why I mentioned Joshua 5, because it makes it very clear then that that's exactly the account. And so God didn't leave us without question. He shows us always how to count things, how to do things. And if people could acknowledge Joshua 5 is this fulfillment of Leviticus 23, and they were to do it from then on, every first day of the week after the Sabbath, they were to have the wave sheaf. Verse 11, and they shall offer, or they shall wave the sheaf before the Eternal be accepted for you. On the morrow after the Sabbath shall the priest wave it. So again, we need to recognize that the wave sheaf is, again, a vital part of the days of unleavened bread. It's a part of the days of unleavened bread, and that the wave sheaf must always be within the days of unleavened bread. Verse 12, and you shall offer that day when you wave the sheaf, again here, a male lamb without blemish. So all these accounts here, always showing what it's all about. It's about Jesus Christ, a male lamb without blemish, had no sin, of the first year for a burnt offering unto the Eternal. Again, Jesus Christ offering himself up for the sins of all mankind. Leviticus 23, verse 14, and you shall eat neither bread nor parched corn, nor green ears, until the selfsame day that you have brought an offering unto your God. We didn't have time this year, but maybe next year we'll spend the time of going into Joshua 5. Just to add to this, it's good that we go back and review these things from year to year, because this is a process here of things that even people in the church have never understood, or some haven't understood. We began to understand it in 1974. Mr. Armstrong, when he understood that Pentecost was always to be on a Sunday, it started with this process, understanding that Joshua 5 is about this very occasion of when they came into the Promised Land. And so they were not to eat of the bread, nor the parched corn, nor the green ears, until the selfsame day that you brought an offering unto your God. And so again, the wave sheaf, they couldn't partake of the harvest that they were already harvesting until that moment in time. And that's why in the Old Testament you'll find some have translated it as the old grain, or the old, they think it was the grain that was from the year before that they were eating, you know, because they won't acknowledge what this is fulfilling. Verse 15, and you shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath. So this is important to understand, brethren, why God would have us start counting something here at this point in time, from the time of the wave sheaf, which was on the first day of the week like this always, after the Sabbath, picturing Jesus Christ as our wave sheaf being weighed before God for us, to be accepted of God for us. And so it tells us here then something to begin doing from that day forward. And you shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the wave sheaf, or the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be complete. So you start counting forward. By the first Sabbath, one week has gone by, and you keep counting until you've gone 7 complete Sabbaths, even into the morrow after the 7th Sabbath. What is the morrow after the 7th Sabbath? First day of the week again. First day of the week again. You shall number 50 days. And that's the only way you can get 50 days out of it. You start with that wave sheaf offering. You count forward the first week till Sabbath is 7 days fulfilled. And by the time you've gone 7 Sabbaths, you have 49. And then the next day is 50. Pentecost. That's why I marvel sometimes how we could believe anything different. It's so clear now. But there was a time in the church for 5 years for me, that I was convicted that Pentecost was on Monday. Because we didn't know. And it seems so clear. And I look at it now and think, I don't know how that could have been clearer. But, you know, if God doesn't let you see something, you don't see it. Just like Mary did not know that that was Jesus Christ until he let her see him. Just like those two that walked with Christ. If we read a little bit farther in the account there, when Jesus Christ was walking and the two walked with him, they said, you know, didn't our hearts burn within ourselves when we heard his words? But until he was gone, then they knew it was Christ. Because God, it's just like he removed a veil from their mind and now they could see it. But they couldn't until God let them. It's an awesome thing to understand. Verse 17, you shall bring out of your habitations. Notice this. You're to count forward 50 days up to Pentecost, and then notice what you're to do. You shall bring out of your habitation 2 wave loaves of 2/10 deals, measurement, and they shall be a fine flour, and they shall be baked with leaven. So out of all of Israel here, there's a part of what you're supposed to go get. The point being is that out of all of us, we all have leaven in our lives. And you're to take these loaves, in essence, and you're to bake them with leaven. We're leavened. And so that's what showing when you come up to Pentecost. Jesus Christ is unleavened. We come to this point in time now, and we're leavened. So this is picturing us, the first fruits. And frankly, all who are called in time are the same, but this is a very specific phase of God's plan, being the first fruits. It says, they shall be baked with leaven. They are the first fruits. And this is the word for first fruits unto the eternal. So why are the first fruits, again, baked with leaven? Because that's the way we are in our lives. And we have sin. And so these 2 loaves are going to be waved up before God, just like the wave sheaf was offered up. So 50 days later, after 7 Sabbaths are complete, add one more day, that following day, just like the wave sheaf, is a time where another wave offering took place before God, picturing the first fruits, that we're to be accepted up before God. Awesome, the beauty of God's plan. It really is, brethren. Verse 20, and the priest shall wave them with the bread of the first fruits, speaking of the offerings here, the things that were offered up. All this was to be done on this particular day of Pentecost, shall wave them with the bread of the first fruits for a wave offering before the eternal with the 2 lambs, and they shall be holy unto the eternal for the priests. So they were counting from the wave sheaf to the wave loaves, and this counting, brethren, ties the 2 together. That's what's beautiful about this. It ties the 2 together. The wave sheaf, makes it possible for the first fruits. The wave offering that was offered up before God makes it possible for the first fruits. And that's why they're tied together like this by God. That we're to count forward, and it's about us being a part of that plan. So again, a great part of the phase, a phase of God's plan. You know, there's that which comes later on, that's pictured in the Feast of Tabernacles and things that happen later on in God's plan. And all have to go through the same process here. All will be unleavened in life as well. But this is very specific, in a very specific phase of God's plan. That's why God so looks forward to the time when Jesus Christ returns here in a very few years. And 144,000 are resurrected that have been prepared for 6,000 years. And they'll all be resurrected. And this is what's being fulfilled here. Amazing. All of them have been received by God through time because of the wave sheaf. Without the wave sheaf, you know, we wouldn't be here. So again, our wave sheaf makes it possible that we can be accepted by God. So with that, we're going to let you out early today. We're going to stop there because that fulfills the entire picture of the wave sheaf offering and the purpose and so forth that's accomplished. That brings us up to the next holy day season when we'll come together again, which is Pentecost.